had not eaten. This had not stopped Napoleon from shouting gleefully to Ney, "We've got 90 chances in 100, 9 out of 10. At 8 o'clock, the emperor was brought his breakfast. He had invited several generals. While they were eating, the story was told of how Wellington had been at a ball in Brussels the night before the last, at the home of the Duchess of Richmond, and Soult, roughneck man of war that he was, with the face of an archbishop, said, "The ball is today." The emperor had joked with Ney, who said, "Wellington would not be so silly as to wait for your majesty." That was the way he spoke. "He liked to tease," says Fleury de Chaboulon. "His nature was basically cheerful," says Gourgaud. "He was full of jokes, not so much witty as bizarre," says Benjamin Constant. These jests of the giant are worth emphasizing. It was he who called his grenadiers les grognards, the whiners. He would pinch their ears, he would pull their moustaches. "All he ever did was play practical jokes on us," so said one of them. During the mysterious trip from the Isle of Elba to France, on February 27th, on the open seas, the French warship Zephyr, having encountered the brig Inconstant, on which Napoleon was hidden, and having asked for news of Napoleon from the Inconstant, the emperor, who was at the time still wearing the white cockade on his hat and the amaranth strewn with bees he had adopted on the Isle of Elba, had grabbed the megaphone, chortling, and himself replied, "The emperor is doing well." Whoever can laugh like that is on good terms with events. Napoleon had several similar jolly outbursts over that Waterloo breakfast. After breakfast, he collected his thoughts for a quarter of an hour. Then two generals came and sat on the bale of hay, plume in hand, a sheet of paper each on their knees, and the emperor dictated the order of battle to them. At 9 o'clock, at the instant the French army, echeloned and set in motion in 5 columns, was deployed, the divisions in 2 lines, the artillery between the brigades, music at the head, belting out marches with drum rolls and trumpet blasts, powerful, vast, jubilant, a sea of helmets, swords and bayonets all the way to the horizon, the emperor, much moved, cried out twice, "Magnificent! Magnificent!" Between 9 o'clock and 10:30, incredible as it seems, the whole army took up position and lined up in 6 rows, forming, to borrow an expression of the emperor's, the figure of 6 V's. A few moments after the formation of the battlefront, amid that profound silence that is the calm before the storm of a fray, seeing the 3 batteries of 12-pounders file past, detached by his orders from the 3 corps of d'Erlon, Ré, and Lobau, and intended to begin the action by battering Mont-Saint-Jean at the intersection of the roads from Nivelles and Genappe, the emperor clapped Oxo on the shoulder and said to him, "There's 24 beauties for you, general." Sure of the outcome, he smiled encouragement as he watched pass in front of him the company of sappers of the 1st Corps, which he had designated to set up barricades at Mont-Saint-Jean once the village was won. All this serenity was marred only by a word of arrogant pity, when he saw on his left, at a spot that is today the site of a great tomb, the admirable Scottish greys massing with their superb horses, he said, "What a shame." Then he hopped on his horse, rode out from Rossomme, and chose his observation post, a small grassy knoll on the right of the road from Genappe to Brussels, which was his 2nd station during the battle. The 3rd station, the one from 7 o'clock in the evening, between La Belle Alliance and La Haie Sainte, is frightening. Still there today, it is a rather high mound behind which the guards had massed on a reverse slope of the plain. Around this mound, cannonballs ricocheted over the paved roadway right up to Napoleon. As at Brienne, cannonballs and bullets whistled over his head. Almost at the very same spot where his horse's feet were, scarred balls, old saber blades, and warped projectiles eaten with rust have been collected. Scabra rubigine. A few years back, a 60-pound shell was disinterred, still loaded. Its fuse had broken off flush with the bomb. It was at this last station that the emperor said to his guide, Lacoste, a frightened, hostile peasant tied to a hussar's saddle, turning round at every volley of shots and trying to hide behind him, "Idiot, this is shameful. You'll get yourself shot in the back." he who writes these lines himself, found in the friable slope of a mound, by digging in the sand, the remains of the neck of a bomb decomposed by the oxide of 46 years, along with some old bits of iron that snapped like elderberry twigs between his fingers. As everybody knows, the varying undulations of the plains where the encounter between Napoleon and Wellington took place are no longer what they were on June 18, 1815. In taking from that deadly field what was needed to make a monument to it, they took away its contours, and history, aghast, no longer recognizes itself there. In order to glorify it, they disfigured it. When Wellington saw Waterloo again 2 years later, he cried, "They've changed my battlefield on me." Where today there is the Great Pyramid of Earth surmounted by a lion, there was a ridge sloping down toward the Nivelle Road in a negotiable ramp. But on the Genappe roadway side, this ridge was almost an escarpment. The elevation of the escarpment can still be measured today by the height of the two great burial mounds that hem in the Genappe to Brussels road. One of these, the English grave, is on the left, the other, the German grave, is on the right. There is no French grave. For France, the entire plain is a sepulchre. Thanks to the thousands and thousands of cartloads of dirt used in the knoll, which is 150 feet high and 500 feet in circumference, the plateau of Mont Saint-Jean is today accessible by means of a gentle incline. On the day of battle, especially on the Lysanne side, it was tough going, steep and sheer. The slope there was so steep that the English cannon could not see the farm below them at the bottom of the valley that was the center of the action. On June 18, 1815, the runoff from the heavy rain accentuated the steepness further, the mire making the climb even harder. They not only struggled up but got stuck in the mud. All the way along the plateau ridge ran a sort of ditch that an observer could not possibly make out at any distance. What was this ditch? We'll tell you. Braine-l'Alleud is a village in Belgium. Ohain is another. These villages, both hidden in the curves of the terrain, are joined by a path about 1.5 leagues long that cuts across an undulating plain and often dips into and buries itself in among the hills like a furrow, which means that at various points the road becomes a ravine. In 1815, as now, the road cut across the ridge of the Mont Saint-Jean plateau between the Genappe and Nivelle roads. But while today it is on a level with the plain, it was then a sunken road. They have taken away both its embankments for the Knoll Monument. This road was, and still is, a trench for most of its length. A trench sometimes 12 feet deep, whose two steep embankments would collapse here and there, especially in winter in the rain. Accidents happened there. The road was so narrow at the entrance to Braine-l'Alleud that a traveller was crushed there by a wagon, as attested by a stone cross standing near the cemetery that gives the name of the dead man as Monsieur Bernard de Brie, merchant of Brussels, and the date of the accident as February 1637. It was so deep along the Mont Saint-Jean plateau that a peasant, Mathieu Niquez, was flattened there in 1783 by a landslide when the embankment collapsed, as is attested by another stone cross, the crown of which has disappeared in all the clearing, but whose overturned pedestal is still visible today on the grass-covered verge on the left side of the road between La Hyacinthe and the Mont Saint-Jean farm. On the day of battle, this sunken road, which nothing gave away, bordering the Mont Saint-Jean ridge, a ditch at the top of the escarpment, a rut hidden in the terrain, was invisible, that is, treacherous and terrible. The emperor puts a question to Lacoste, the guide. And so, on the morning of Waterloo, Napoleon was happy. He had reason to be. The battle plan he had designed, as we have seen, was indeed admirable. Once the battle was underway, its extremely various episodes, the resistance of Hougoumont, the tenacity of La Hyacinthe, Baudouin killed, Foy put out of action, the unexpected wall against which Soye's brigade was smashed, Guiminot's fatal blunder in having neither explosives nor sacks of powder, the bogging down of the batteries, the 15 guns without an escort toppled by Uxbridge along a sunken path, the underwhelming effect of the bombs falling on the English lines and burrowing into the rain-soaked ground, succeeding only in creating volcanoes of mud so that the hail of shot turned into spattering, the uselessness of Piret's performance at Braine-l'Alleud, all that cavalry, 15 squadrons virtually annihilated, the right wing of the English hardly turning a hair, the left wing barely grazed, Ney's strange misunderstanding that saw him massing, instead of echeloning, the four divisions of the First Corps, causing men in rows 27 deep and in fronts of 200 to be delivered up to the hail of shot accordingly, the awful hole cut in these masses by the cannonballs, the attacking columns split up, the supporting battery suddenly uncovered along their flank, Bourgeois, Donzelot, and Durutte compromised, Quiot pushed back, Lieutenant Vieux, that Hercules who had sprung from the École Polytechnique, wounded at the very moment he was hoeing into the La Haie Sainte gate with an axe under the plunging fire of the English barricade, blocking the bend in the Genappe-Brussels road. Marconnet's division caught between infantry and cavalry, gunned down at point-blank range in the wheat by Best and Pack, cut down by Ponsonby, his battery of seven pieces pinned, the Prince of Saxe-Weimar holding and keeping Frischemont and Smohain, despite the Comte d'Erlon, the colours of the 105th taken, the colours of the 45th taken. This Prussian black hussar, brought in by the scouts of the flying column of 300 chasseurs, scouring the countryside between Vavre and Planchenoit, and the disturbing things the prisoner had said. Grouchy's delay, the 1,500 men killed in less than an hour in the orchard of Hougoumont, the 1,800 men mown down in even less time around La Haie Sainte. All these storm-filled incidents, passing like battle clouds before Napoleon, had scarcely troubled his gaze, and had not dimmed the certainty in that imperial face. Napoleon was used to staring hard at war. He never did the poignant sums of details. Figure by figure, figures mattered little to him, as long as they amounted to this total victory. If the beginnings went wrong, he did not get alarmed, for he believed himself master and possessor of the ends. He knew how to bide his time, supposing himself outside the equation. And he dealt with destiny as an equal. He seemed to say to fate, "You wouldn't dare." Half light, half shadow, Napoleon felt himself protected when things were going well, and tolerated when they were going badly. He had on his side, or thought he did, a collusion, you might almost say a complicity, on the part of events, equivalent to antique invulnerability. Yet when you have Berezina, Leipzig, and Fontainebleau behind you, it seems you might not take Waterloo on trust. A mysterious frown becomes visible high overhead in the sky. The moment Wellington fell back, Napoleon quivered. He suddenly saw the plateau of Mont-Saint-Jean laid bare and the front of the English army disappear. It rallied but kept out of sight. The Emperor half rose in his stirrups. The lightning of victory flashed in his eyes. Wellington, driven back to the forest of Soignes and destroyed, that was the final overthrow of England by France. That was Crécy, Poitiers, Malplaquet, and Ramilly avenged. The man from Marengo was cancelling out Agincourt. Musing on the terrible episode to come, the Emperor then ran his field glasses one last time over every point of the battlefield. His guard, their weapons at their feet behind him, observed him from below with a sort of religious fervor, something close to worship. He was thinking. He was studying the hillsides, noting the slopes, scrutinizing the clumps of trees, the square patch of rye, the track. He seemed to be counting every bush. He looked for some time at the English barricades on both roadways. Two broad abatis of felled trees, the one on the Genappe road, above La Haie Sainte, equipped with two cannons, the only ones in the whole of the English artillery trained on the battlefield, and the one on the Nivelle road, where the Dutch bayonets of Chassé's brigade glinted. He noticed, close by this barricade, the old white chapel of Saint-Nicolas, which stands next to the track to Braine-l'Alleud. He leaned over and spoke in a half-whisper to Lacoste, the guide. The guide shook his head, to say no, probably treacherously. The Emperor straightened up and gathered himself together. Wellington had backed off. All that remained was to finish off this retreat with a crushing defeat. Napoleon suddenly turned round and sent off a courier at full gallop to Paris to announce that the battle was won. Napoleon was one of those geniuses, that release thunder. He had just found his thunderbolt. He gave the order to Meaux's cuirassiers to take the plateau of Mont-Saint-Jean. The Unexpected. They were 3,500 strong. They made a front half a mile long. They were giant men on colossal horses. They were 26 squadrons, and they had behind them, to lend them support, the division of Le Ferre des Nouettes, the 106 elite gendarmes, the chasseurs of the guard, 1,197 men, and the lancers of the guard, 880 lances. They wore plumeless helmets and cuirasses of beaten iron, with cavalry pistols in their holsters and long sabers. In the morning, the whole army had been filled with admiration for them when at 9 o'clock, with bugles blaring, all the bands playing Veillons au salut de l'Empire, Let's see to the salvation of the Empire, they had come in a dense column, one of their batteries at their flank, the other at their center, to fan out over two rows between the Genappe Road and Frischemont and take up their battle position in this powerful second line, so wisely drawn up by Napoleon, which, with Kellermann's cuirassier at its left end and Meaux's cuirassier at its right, had, so to speak, two wings of iron. The aide-de-camp, Bernard, delivered the Emperor's order to them. Ned drew his sword and placed himself at the helm. The enormous squadrons began to move. Then a formidable spectacle was seen. This whole cavalry, sabers raised, standards and trumpets to the wind, formed into a column by division, descended in unison and as one with the precision of a bronze battering ram opening a breach, the hill of La Belle Alliance, sank into the dreadful depths where so many men had already fallen, vanished there in the smoke, then, emerging from the shadows, reappeared on the other side of the valley of shadow, still compact and serried, rising at full trot through the cloud of gunshot bursting overhead up the awful mud slope of the Mont-Saint-Jean plateau. They rose, grave, menacing, imperturbable. In the lulls in the shooting and artillery fire, you could hear the colossal sound of shuffling. Being two divisions, they were in two columns. Battier's division had the right, Delors to the left. From a distance they looked like two immense steel snakes stretching out toward the crest of the plateau. They passed through the battle like a miracle. Nothing like it had been seen since the taking of the great redoubt of the Moskva by the heavy cavalry. Murat was missing, but Ney had popped up again. It seemed as though the mass had become a monster with only one soul. Each squadron undulated and swelled like the rings of a polyp. They could be seen through a vast cloud of thick smoke, torn here and there. A jumble of helmets, shouting, sabers, the tumultuous bouncing of horses' rumps among the cannon and the fanfare, a disciplined and terrible commotion. Over all, the cuirasses, like the scales over a hydra. These tales seemed to belong to another age. Something like this vision appeared, no doubt, in the old Orphic sagas, telling of centaurs, antique hippanthropes, those titans with human faces and equine chests, who scaled Olympus, gambling, horrible creatures, invulnerable, sublime. Gods and beasts, both. In a bizarre coincidence of numbers, 26 battalions were to be joined by these 26 squadrons. Behind the crest of the plateau, under cover of the masked battery, the English infantry formed into 13 squares, 2 battalions to a square, and in 2 lines, 7 in the first, 6 in the second, rifle butts at the shoulder, taking aim at whatever happened along, waiting, calm, mute, unmoving. They could not see the cuirassiers, and the cuirassiers could not see them. They listened to the tide of men rising. They heard the growing noise of 3,000 horses, the alternating and symmetrical knocking of their shod hooves at full trot, the rattling of the cuirasses, the clang of sabers, and a sort of great fierce murmur. There was a fearful silence. Then, suddenly, a long line of raised arms brandishing sabers appeared above the crest, along with helmets and trumpets and standards, and 3,000 heads with grey moustaches, all crying, "Long live the Emperor!" The entire cavalry poured out onto the plateau, and it was like the start of an earthquake. All of a sudden, tragically, to the left of the English, to our right, the head of the column of cuirassiers reared up with a frightening clamour. Having reached the culminating point of the crest, frantic, full of fury, and hell-bent on exterminating the squares and cannons, the cuirassiers had just seen a ditch, a pit, between them and the English. It was the sunken road of Ohain. The moment was horrifying. There was the ravine, unexpected, yawning right at the horse's hooves, 2 fathoms deep between its twin banks. The second row pushed the first in, and the third pushed the second. The horses reared, threw themselves backward, fell on their rumps, slid with their 4 feet in the air, knocking off and crushing their riders, no way of turning back. The entire column was now no more than a projectile. The force gathered to crush the English crushed the French. The inexorable ravine could not surrender until it was filled. Riders and horses rolled into it pell-mell, grinding each other, forming one flesh in this gulf, and when the pit was full of men still alive, they marched over them, and the remainder followed suit. Almost a third of Dubois' brigade toppled into this abyss. This was the beginning of the end of the battle. A local tradition, obviously exaggerated, has it that 2,000 horses and 1,500 men were buried in the sunken road of Ohain. This figure probably includes all the other corpses that were thrown into the ravine the day after the fighting. We might note in passing that it was the same brigade, Dubois' brigade, so fatally tested, that had charged separately an hour earlier and taken the colours of the Lunebourg battalion. Napoleon, before ordering this charge of Millau's cuirassiers, had carefully examined the terrain but had not been able to see the sunken road, which did not create so much as a wrinkle on the surface of the plateau. Warned, however, and put on his guard by the little white chapel that marks its junction with the Nivelle Road, he had put a question to Lacoste, the guide, probably about the possibility of any obstacle. The guide had replied in the negative. You might go so far as to say that catastrophe came to Napoleon from that shake of a peasant's head. Further bad luck was to ensue. Could Napoleon possibly have won the battle? We say no. Why? Because of Wellington? Because of Blücher? No. Because of God. Bonaparte as the victor at Waterloo. This was no longer in the law of the 19th century. A different series of feats was gearing up in which there was no more room for Napoleon. The bad grace of events had announced itself long before. It was high time this mighty man fell. The excessive weight of this man in human destiny upset the balance. This one individual alone weighed more than the population of the world. This plethora of all human vitality concentrated in a single head. The world going to the brain of one man would be mortal to civilization if it were to go on. The moment had come for the incorruptible supreme equity to sort things out. Most likely the principles and elements on which the regular movements in both the moral order and the material order depend were beginning to groan. The fuming blood, the overflowing cemeteries, the mothers in tears, these are powerful pleas for the defense. When the earth is surfeited, there are mysterious wailings from the shadows that the abyss picks up. Napoleon had been impeached before the infinite, and his fall had been decreed. He was embarrassing God. Waterloo is not a battle. It is a shift in the world's front. The Plateau of Mont-Saint-Jean. At the same time as the ravine, the artillery showed itself. 60 cannon and the 13 squares blasted the cuirassiers at point-blank range. The intrepid General Delors gave the military salute to the English battery. The whole of the English mobile artillery slammed into the squares at a gallop. The cuirassiers did not have time to pause for breath. the disaster of the sunken road had decimated but not discouraged them. They were the kind of men who, diminished in number, grew in heart. Vatier's column alone had been cobbled by the disaster. Delors' column, which Ney had sent veering off to the left as though he had divined the trap, had arrived intact. The cuirassiers hurled themselves at the English squares, galloping furiously, reins let loose and flying, sabers in their teeth, pistols in their fists. Such was the assault. There are moments in battle when the soul hardens the man to the point of turning a soldier into a statue, and when all that flesh converts to granite. The English battalions, wildly beset, did not budge. So it was truly frightening. All sides of the English squares were attacked at once. A frenetic swirl enveloped them. That cold-blooded infantry remained impassive. The first row, on their knees, received the cuirassiers on the ends of their bayonets. The second row gunned them down. Behind the second row, the cannoneers loaded their pieces, the front of the square opened up, made way for an eruption of firepower, and then closed again. The cuirassiers responded by crushing them. Their great horses reared up, leaped over the ranks, jumped over the bayonets, and fell, gigantic, in the middle of those four living walls. The cannonballs made holes in the cuirassiers. The cuirassiers made breaches in the squares. Files of men disappeared, ground to a pulp underneath the horses. The bayonets sank into the guts of those centaurs, creating perhaps the most monstrous wounds perhaps ever seen anywhere. The squares, eaten into by the frenzied cavalry, dwindled without flinching. Scattering shot without let-up, they exploded amid their assailants. The combat was a monstrous sight. The squares were no longer battalions, they were craters. The cuirassiers were no longer a cavalry, they were a shocking storm. Each square was a volcano attacked by a swarming cloud. Lava did battle with lightning. The square on the far right, which was the most exposed of all, being out in the open, was almost annihilated in the first few clashes. It was made up of the 75th Regiment of Highlanders. The bagpipe player in the center, paying absolutely no attention while everyone was busy exterminating each other all around him, cast down his melancholy eyes full of the reflection of forests and lakes, and played Highland ditties, sitting on a drum with his bagpipes under his arm. Those Scots died thinking of Ben Lothian, as the Greeks died remembering Argos. A cuirassier's sabre, smiting the bagpipe and the arm that held it, stopped the song by killing the player. Relatively few in number, reduced by the disaster of the ravine, the cuirassiers had the whole English army arrayed against them there, but they were everywhere at once, each man suddenly finding the strength of 10. Meanwhile, some of the Hanoverian battalions buckled. Wellington noticed and remembered his cavalry. If Napoleon, even at that moment, had thought of his infantry, he would have won the battle. This forgetfulness was his fatal mistake. All of a sudden, the attacking cuirassiers realized they were being attacked in turn. The English cavalry were upon them, in front of them the squares, behind them Somerset. Somerset meant the 1,400 dragoons. Somerset had Dornberg on his right, with the German light horse, and on his left Trip, with the Belgian carabinier. The cuirassiers attacked head and flank, front and rear, by the infantry and the cavalry, had to square up on all sides. What did they care? They were a whirlwind. Their bravery was beyond words. They had behind them the relentlessly booming battery to boot. They had to have, for these men to be wounded in the back. One of their cuirasses, with a bullet hole through the left shoulder plate, is in the collection of the so-called Waterloo Museum. For such Frenchmen, nothing less than such Englishmen would do. It was no longer a melee. It was a squall, a rampage, a dizzying fit of courageous hearts and souls, a hurricane of swords flashing. In an instant, the 1,400 dragoons were down to no more than 800. Fuller, their lieutenant colonel, fell dead. Ney rushed in with the lancers and chasseurs of Le Ferre-Dinouet. The plateau of Mont-Saint-Jean was taken back, taken again. The cuirassiers left the cavalry to return to the infantry, or, more accurately, all this formidable throng wrestled with each other without letting go their hold. The squares were still holding. There were 12 attacks. Ney had 4 horses killed under him. Half of the cuirassiers stayed on the plateau. The struggle lasted 2 hours. The English army was profoundly shaken. There is no doubt that if the cuirassiers hadn't been crippled in their first clash by the disaster of the sunken road, they would have overwhelmed the center and carried the victory. This extraordinary cavalry petrified Clinton, who had seen Talavera and Badajoz. Wellington, 3/4 vanquished, was struck with heroic admiration. He said in a half-whisper, "Splendid." The cuirassiers annihilated 7 out of 13 squares, took or spiked 60 cannon pieces, and captured 6 colors from the English regiments, which 3 cuirassiers and 3 chasseurs of the guard brought to the emperor out in front of the farm at La Belle Alliance. Wellington's situation had deteriorated. This strange battle was like a duel between 2 determined, wounded men who, both fighting and fending off all the while, lose all their blood. Which of the 2 would drop first? The Battle of the Plateau raged on. How far did the cuirassiers get? No one can really say. What is certain is that the day after the battle, a cuirassier and his horse were found dead in the framework of the machine for weighing vehicles at Mont-Saint-Jean, at the very point where the 4 roads from Nivelle, Genappe, La Hulpe, and Brussels come together and cut across each other. This cavalier had got through the English lines. One of the men who carted away the body still lives in Mont-Saint-Jean. His name is Deaz. He was 18 years old at the time. Wellington felt himself buckling. The end was near. The cuirassiers had not succeeded in the sense that the center was not overrun. Since everyone had the plateau, no one had it, and in a word, it remained for the greater part to the English. Wellington had the village and the crowning plain. Ney only had the ridge and the slope. On both sides they seemed rooted to this deathly soil. But the English looked irremediably weakened. The hemorrhage of that army was horrible. Kempt on the left wing called for reinforcements. "There aren't any," Wellington replied. "Let him get himself killed." Almost at the same instant, in an odd coincidence that shows how exhausted both armies were, Ney asked Napoleon for infantry, and Napoleon shouted, "Infantry! Where does he want me to get them from? Would he like me to pull them out of a hat?" Yet the English army was the sicker. The furious onslaughts of these great squadrons, with their iron cuirasses and chests of steel, had ground up the infantry. A few men around a flag marked the place of 1 regiment. Another battalion was now commanded only by some lieutenant's captain. Alten's division, already so badly battered at La Haye Sainte, was almost destroyed. The intrepid Belgians of Van Kluze's brigade were strewn over the fields of rye all along the Nivelle Road. There were almost none left of the Dutch grenadiers who joined our ranks in Spain in 1811 to fight against Wellington and who rallied to the English in 1815 in their fight against Napoleon. The loss among officers was considerable. Lord Uxbridge, who the next day buried his leg, had a fractured knee. On the side of the French in this battle of the cuirassiers, Delors, Lhérité, Colbert, Knop, Travers, and Blancard were out of action. But on the side of the English, Alten was wounded, Barne was wounded, Delancey was killed, Van Mieren was killed, Amteda was killed, Wellington's entire staff was decimated, and England came off worse in this bloody juggling act. The 2nd Regiment of Foot Guards had lost 5 lieutenant colonels, 4 captains, and 3 ensigns. The 1st Battalion of the 30th Infantry had lost 24 officers and 112 soldiers. The 79th Highlanders had 24 officers wounded, 18 officers dead, and 450 soldiers killed. Cumberland's Hanoverian Hussars, an entire regiment, led by Colonel Hacke, who would later be court-martialed and cashiered, had turned tail at the sight of the melee and were fleeing through the forest of Soignes, sowing panic all the way to Brussels. Carts, gun carriages, supply and baggage wagons, wagons full of the wounded, seeing the French gaining ground and closing in on the forest, rushed there. The Dutch, cut down by the French cavalry, gave the alarm, "Get out now!" From Veercoucou right up to Groenendaal, over a length of nearly 6 miles in the direction of Brussels, the road was jammed with people running for their lives, according to witnesses still alive today. The panic was so great that it reached the Prince de Condé at Malines and Louis XVIII at Ghent. With the exception of the paltry reserve echeloned behind the ambulance station set up in the Mont-Saint-Jean farm, and the brigades of Vivian and Vandeleur that flanked the left wing, Wellington had run out of cavalry. A number of batteries were scattered around unhorsed. These facts have been admitted by Syburn, and Pringle, exaggerating the disaster, even goes so far as to say that the Anglo-Dutch army was reduced to 34,000 men. The Iron Duke remained calm, but his lips were white. The Austrian commissary, Vincent, the Spanish commissary, Alava, who watched the battle with the English staff, thought the Duke was finished. At 5 o'clock, Wellington pulled out his watch and was heard to murmur these somber words, "Blücher, or night." It was at about that point that a distant line of bayonets flashed on the heights around Frischemont. This was the turning point in this colossal tragedy. Bad guide for Napoleon, good guide for Bülow. We all know about Napoleon's heartbreaking mistake. How Grouchy was expected while Blücher turned up, death instead of life. Destiny makes such about-faces. You are hoping to sit on the world's throne, and instead you spy St. Helena looming. If the little shepherd who served as a guide to Bülow, Blücher's lieutenant, had advised him to come out of the forest above Frischemont rather than below Planchenoit, the shape of the 19th century would perhaps have been different. Napoleon would have won the Battle of Waterloo. By any other road than below Planchenoit, the Prussian army would have ended up at a ravine the artillery could not have crossed, and Bülow would not have got there. Just an hour's delay, as the Prussian general Muffling said, and Blücher would not have found Wellington standing. The battle would have been lost. It was high time, as we have seen, that Blücher turned up. He had been delayed for a considerable while. He had bivouacked at Dion-les-Monts and set out at dawn. But the roads were inaccessible, and his divisions got stuck in the mud. The cannons were bogged right up to their hubs. On top of this, they had to cross the Dyle over the narrow bridge at Wavre. The road leading to the bridge had been set on fire by the French, and the ammunition caissons and artillery wagons, not being able to pass between two rows of burning houses, had had to wait for the fire to be put out. It was midday before Bülow's advance guard could get even as far as Chapelle Saint-Lambert. Had the action begun 2 hours earlier, it would have been over by four, and Blücher would have fallen in the battle won by Napoleon. Such are the immense strokes of luck, good or bad, that are calibrated by an infinity that escapes us. As early as midday, the Emperor was the first with his telescope to notice something on the horizon that caught his attention. He had said, "I see a cloud over there that looks to me like troops." Then he had asked the Duc de Dalmatia, "Soult, what do you see over toward Chapelle Saint-Lambert?" The Maréchal, training his field glasses that way, had answered, 4 or 5,000 men, sire. Obviously, it's Grouchy." Yet they remained motionless in the mist. The glasses of the whole staff studied the cloud signaled by the Emperor. Some said, "Their columns taking a break." Most said, "Those are trees." The truth is that the cloud did not stir. The Emperor sent Domon's division of light horse off to reconnoitre that dark spot. Bülow had not, in fact, moved. His vanguard was very weak and could do nothing. He had to wait for the bulk of his army corps, and he'd been given the order to mass his forces before entering into battle. But at 5 o'clock, seeing the peril Wellington was in, Blücher ordered Bülow to attack and said this remarkable thing, "We must give the English army time to come up for air." A little later, the divisions of Lostin, Hiller, Hacke, and Rissel fanned out in front of Lobau's corps. The cavalry of Prince William of Prussia came out of the Paris wood, Planchenoit was in flames, and the Prussian cannonballs began to rain down as far as the rows of the reserve guard behind Napoleon. The Guard. We know the rest. The eruption of a third army, the disintegration of the battle, 86 fire-breathing maws suddenly thundering, Pirch the first surging forward with Bülow, Zieten's cavalry led by Blücher in person, the French driven back, Marconnier swept off the Anhin plateau, Durutte dislodged from Papelotte, Donzelot and Quillot beating a retreat, Lobau sideswiped, a new battle gearing up as night fell over the dismantled regiments, the whole English line taking the offensive once again and driven forward, the gigantic hole made in the French army, the hail of English bullets and the hail of Prussian bullets lending each other support, the extermination, disaster along the front, disaster along the flank, the guard falling into line under this horrifying collapse. As though they sensed they were about to die, the guards cried out, "Long live the Emperor!" History has nothing more moving than this death rattle bursting out into acclamation. The sky had been covered the whole day. Suddenly, at that very moment, it was 8 o'clock at night, the clouds on the horizon parted, and through the elms on the Nivelle Road, the great sinister redness of the setting sun streamed in. At Austerlitz, the sun had been rising. Each battalion of the guard for this final scene was commanded by a general. Friant, Michel, Roguet, Arlet, Mallet, Poré de Morvan were there. When the high, black bearskin hats of the grenadiers, decorated with the wide eagle plate, emerged from the fog of war, symmetrical, aligned, tranquil, superb, the enemy felt respect for France. It felt as if they were watching 20 victories entering the battlefield, wings spread. And those who were victors, considering themselves vanquished, shrank back. But Wellington shouted, "On your feet, guards, and aim straight!" The red regiment of the English guards, lying behind the hedges, rose. A cloud of canister shot riddled the tricolor flag, fluttering around our eagles. Everyone lunged forward, and the final carnage began. The Imperial Guard could feel the army slipping away around them in the gloom and the vast shock of the rout. They heard the "every man for himself" that had replaced the "long live the Emperor," and despite all the men fleeing behind them, they continued to advance, more and more of them mauled and dying at every step they took. Not one of them hesitated or weakened. Every soldier in the troop was as much a hero as the general. Not one man balked at the suicide. Ney, in despair, grand with all the arrogance of acceptance of death, offered himself up to any and all blows in this torment. His fifth horse was killed under him there. Streaming with sweat, eyes aflame, foaming at the mouth, uniform unbuttoned, one of his epaulets half ripped off by the saber slash of a horse guardsman, his great eagle plate dented by a bullet, bleeding, covered in mud, magnificent, a broken sword in hand, he said, "Come and see how a Maréchal of France dies on the field of battle." In vain, for he did not die. He was crazed and filled with outrage. He hurled this question at Drouet d'Erlon. "Aren't you going to get yourself killed then, eh?" He shouted in the middle of all this artillery fire that was mashing a cluster of men, "Isn't there anything for me then? Oh, I'd love all those English bullets straight in the guts." You were reserved for French bullets, poor man. The catastrophe. The rout behind the guard was awful. The army suddenly caved in on all sides at once. Hougoumont, La Haie Sainte, Papelotte, Planchenoit. The cry "treason" was followed by the cry "every man for himself." A disintegrating army is a thaw. Everything buckles, splinters, cracks, floats, rolls, tumbles down, crashes around, darts, rushes headlong. The disarray is unbelievable. Ney borrows a horse, hops up, and without a hat, without a cravat, without a sword, plants himself sideways across the Brussels road, stopping both the English and the French at once. He tries to retain the army. He calls them back. He insults them. He dogs the rout. He is overwhelmed. The soldiers flee from him, crying, "Long live Maréchal Ney!" Two of Durutte's regiments come and go, bewildered and as though tossed between the sabres of the Uhlans and the fusillade of the brigades of Kempt, best pack and Rylant. A rout is the worst kind of melee. Friends kill each other in their bid to get away. Squadrons and battalions smash and send each other flying, sending up a sea foam of battle. Lobo at one end and Ray at the other are rolled in the torrent. In vain Napoleon builds ramparts with what remains of the guard. In vain he expends his reserve squadron in a last-ditch effort. Quillot shrinks back before Vivian. Kellermann before Vandeleur. Lobo before Bülow. Morand before Pirch. Daumont and Subervic before Prince William of Prussia. Guillot, who led the charge of the Emperor's squadrons, falls under the feet of the English dragoons. Napoleon gallops all the way along the rows of fugitives, haranguing them, pressuring them, threatening them, imploring. All those mouths that only that morning were shouting, "Long live the Emperor," are hanging open now. He is barely acknowledged. The Prussian cavalry, freshly arrived, darts in, flies, hacks, lops, kills, exterminates. Yoked teams hurtle off, the cannoneers take to their heels, the soldiers belonging to the train unhitch the ammunition caissons and take their horses to escape. Overturned wagons, their four wheels in the air, block the way and are accessories to massacre. People are crushed to death, trampled. Others walk over the dead and over the living. Arms are lost. A dizzying flood of men pours onto the roads, paths, bridges, plains, hills, valleys, woods, which are choked with this deluge of 40,000 men fleeing for their lives. Shrieks, despair, sacks and fusils thrown into the rye, paths hacked out with swords, no more comrades in arms, no more officers, no more generals, just unspeakable horror. Seton comfortably hacking through France. Lions turned to deer. That is what the flight was like. At Genappe, people tried to turn back, to form a united front, to create a roadblock. Lobo rallied 300 men. They barricaded the entry to the village, but at the first volley of grape shot from the Prussians, everyone took to their heels again, and Lobo was taken. You can still see the mark left by the volley of shot today on the old gable of a brick hovel on the right-hand side of the road, a few minutes before you enter Genappe. The Prussians charged into Genappe, furious, no doubt, at having so little opportunity to play the conquerors. The pursuit was monstrous. Blücher gave the order for extermination. Roguet had set a grim example in threatening to kill any French grenadier who brought him a Prussian prisoner. Blücher outdid Roguet. The general of the young guard, Duhem, nabbed at the door of an inn in Genappe, handed over his sword to a hussar of Def, who took the sword and killed the prisoner. Victory was completed by the assassination of the vanquished. Let us punish, since we are history. Old Blücher disgraced himself. The ferocity took the disaster to dizzying limits. The desperate rout passed through Genappe, passed through Quatre Bras, passed through Gosselies, passed through Frasnes, passed through Charleroi, passed through Thuin, and stopped only at the border. Alas, who was it that was fleeing so desperately? The Grande Armée. Was this craziness, this terror, this collapse in a heap of the greatest bravery that has ever confounded history, without cause? No. The shadow of an enormous right hand looms over Waterloo. It is the day of destiny. The might beyond man made that day. Hence the heads bowed in horror, hence all those great souls yielding up their swords. Those who had conquered Europe fell to the ground, mown down, with nothing more to say or do, sensing a terrible presence in the shadows. Hoc erat infatis. That day the perspective of the human race shifted. Waterloo is the event the 19th century hinges on. The disappearance of the great man was necessary to the coming of the great century. Someone whom you do not answer back saw to it. The panic of those heroes can be explained. In the Battle of Waterloo, there was more than a cloud. There was a meteor. God passed. As night fell, in a field near Genappe, Bernard and Bertrand, seized by the lapels of his redingcoat, and stopped a haggard, pensive, sinister man who, dragged that far by the current of the rout, had just dismounted, slipped his horse's reins under his arm, and wild-eyed, turned back alone to Waterloo. It was Napoleon, still trying to make headway, immense somnambulist of this shattered dream. The Last Square. A few squares of the guard, immobile in the streaming of the rout like rocks in running water, held till nightfall. When night came on and death with it, they waited for that double darkness and let themselves be enveloped by it, unshakable. Each regiment, cut off from the others and with no further communication with the army that had entirely disintegrated, died in its own manner. They had taken up position to fight the final fight, some on the heights of Rossomme, others on the plain of Mont-Saint-Jean. There, abandoned, vanquished, terrible, the solemn squares stood dying tremendously. Ulm, Wagram, Jena, Friedland died with them. At dusk, around 9 in the evening, at the bottom of the plateau of Mont-Saint-Jean, one square remained. In this deathly valley, at the foot of the slope the cuirassiers had scaled, now flooded by the masses of the English, under the converging fire of the artillery of the victorious enemy, under a frightening rain of projectiles, this square fought on. It was commanded by a little-known officer named Cambron. At each discharge, the square diminished but riposted. It met grapeshot with gunfire, constantly contracting its four walls. In the distance, the fugitives, stopping now and then, out of breath, listened in the darkness as the mournful thunder grew fainter. When this legion was no more than a handful, when their flag was no more than a rag, when their fusils had run out of bullets and were no more than batons, when the heap of corpses was bigger than the group left alive, there was among the victors a sort of holy terror over these sublime dying men, and the English artillery, pausing for breath, fell silent. It was respite of a kind. The combatants were surrounded by what seemed like teeming ghosts, the silhouettes of men on horseback, the black outlines of their cannons, the white sky seen through wheels and gun carriages, the colossal death's head that heroes always see in the depths of the fog of war, was closing in on them and looked at them. They could hear in the crepuscular gloom that cannons were being loaded, wicks were being lit, and gleamed like the eyes of tigers in the night, making a circle around their heads. All the shot-firers of the English batteries approached the cannons, and then, deeply moved, holding the moment of reckoning hanging over these men, an English general, Colville according to some, Maitland according to others, cried out to them, "Brave Frenchmen, give yourselves up!" Cambron replied, "Shit!" Cambron. Out of respect for the French reader, the most beautiful word, perhaps, that a Frenchman has ever uttered cannot be repeated to them. There is a ban on dropping the sublime into history. At our own risk, we are violating that ban. So, we say, among all these giants there was a titan, Cambron. To say that word and then die, what could be more grand? For to want death is to die, and it is not this man's fault if, though shot, he survived. The man who won the Battle of Waterloo is not Napoleon, routed. It is not Wellington, buckling at 4 o'clock, desperate at 5. It is not Blücher, who did not fight. The man who won the Battle of Waterloo is Cambron. To strike down the thunderbolt that kills you with such a word, that is to conquer. To answer catastrophe back with that, to say that to fate, to give the lion of the future such a firm footing to slam down that reply at the night's rain, at the treacherous wall of Hougoumont, at the sunken path of Ohain, at Grouchy's delay, at Blücher's arrival, to come up with irony with one foot in the grave, to manage to stay on your feet after you've fallen, to drown the European coalition in one syllable, to offer kings the lavatories already familiar to the Caesars, to make the last of words the first by fusing it with the lightning of France, to insolently bring Waterloo to a close with a Mardi Gras, round off Leonidas with Rabelais. Sum up the victory in one supreme word that cannot be uttered. To lose ground but keep history. After all the carnage, to have the last laugh. This is huge. It is an insult to the thunderbolt. It is to attain the greatness of Aeschylus. Cambronne's word has the effect of a fracture. It means fracturing a breast with scorn. It is overflowing agony exploding. Who won? Wellington? No. Without Blücher, he was sunk. Blücher? No. If Wellington hadn't begun, Blücher could not have finished. This Cambronne, this man who pops up at the final hour, this unknown soldier, this infinitely small cog of war, feels that there is a lie in there, a lie in a catastrophe, a poignant doubling up, and at the instant he is about to burst with rage over this, he is offered this paltry joke, life. How can he not hit the roof? There they are, all the kings of Europe, the happy generals, the thundering Jupiters. There are 100,000 victorious soldiers, and behind the 100,000, a million. Their cannons, wicks lit, are gaping. They have the Imperial Guard and the Grande Armée under their heels. They have just crushed Napoleon, and there is only Cambronne left. There is no one left to protest except this earthworm. Protest he will. So he gropes for a word the way you grope for a sword. He foams at the mouth, and this foam is the word. Faced with this miraculous and mediocre victory, faced with this victory without victors, the desperado holds his head high. He takes the whole enormous calamity on the chin, but he sees its meaninglessness, and he goes one better than spitting on it. And under the overwhelming pressure of numbers, strength, and material circumstances, he finds in his soul an expression, excrement. We repeat it. To say that, to do that, to come up with that, this is to be the victor. The spirit of past glory entered into this unknown man at that fatal moment. Cambronne comes up with the word for Waterloo, the way Rouget de Lille comes up with the Marseillaise, being visited with inspiration from on high. A whiff of the divine whirlwind breaks loose and wafts through such men, and they shudder, and one of them sings the ultimate song, and the other lets out this terrible cry. Cambronne not only slams down this word of titanic scorn at Europe in the name of the Empire, that would be a small thing, he slams it down at the past in the name of the Revolution. You hear it, and you recognize in Cambronne the old soul of the giants. It sounds like Danton talking, or Kléber roaring. To this word of Cambronne's, the English voice replied, "Fire." The batteries blazed, the hill shook. From all those mouths of bronze, one last vomit of shot spewed forth. Appalling. One vast plume of smoke, vaguely whitened by the rising moon, rolled in, and when the smoke cleared, there was nothing left. This formidable remnant was annihilated. The guards were dead. The four living walls of the redoubt were lying prone. You could barely make out a tremor here and there among the corpses. And this is how the French legions, greater than the Roman legions, expired at Mont-Saint-Jean, on ground soaked with rain and blood, in the gloomy wheat fields, at the place where, these days, at 4 in the morning, whistling and cheerily whipping his horse, Joseph trots past on his rounds for the Nivelle mail coach service. Quot libras in duce. The Battle of Waterloo is an enigma. It is as mysterious for those who won it as for the man who lost it. For Napoleon, it was pure panic. Blücher sees nothing in it but excitement. Wellington can't make head or tail of it. Look at the reports. The bulletins are confused, the commentaries muddled. Some stammer, others stutter. Jomini divides the Battle of Waterloo into four moments. Mifflin carves it into three episodes. Charras, alone, although on some points our appreciation differs from his, grasped with his proud glance the characteristic features of this catastrophe of human genius grappling with divine chance. All other historians are dazzled, and in their dazzled state, they are left groping. A blinding day, indeed. The downfall of the military monarchy, which, to the great stupor of the kings, dragged every kingdom down with it. The fall of might, the routing of war. In this event, bearing the marks of superhuman necessity, the role men played is nothing. Does taking Waterloo away from Wellington and Blücher mean taking something away from England and Germany? No. Neither this illustrious England nor that august Germany is in question in the problem of Waterloo. Thank heavens, peoples are great beyond the sorrowful adventures of the sword. Neither Germany, nor England, nor France fit into a scabbard. In these times, when Waterloo is a mere clinking of sabres, above Blücher, Germany has Goethe, and above Wellington, England has Byron. A vast dawning of ideas marks our century, and in this dawn, England and Germany have their magnificent glow. They are majestic in what they think. The raising of the bar they have brought to civilization is intrinsic to them. It comes from themselves and not from some accident. The way they opened up the 19th century does not begin with Waterloo. Only barbarians experience sudden spurts of growth after a victory. That is nothing more than the passing vanity of torrents swollen by a storm. Civilized peoples, especially in our day, are not raised up or brought down by the good or bad luck of a captain. Their specific weight in the human race comes from something more than a fight. Their honor, thank God, their dignity, their radiance, their genius, are not numbers that those gamblers known as heroes and conquerors throw into the lottery of battle. Battle lost, progress is often won. Less glory, more liberty. When the drum shuts up, reason has its say. This is the game of loser wins. So, let us keep our calm, on both sides, when we speak of Waterloo. Let us give to chance what is chance's, and to God what is God's. What is Waterloo? A victory? No. A game of poker. A game of poker won by Europe, paid out by France. It really wasn't worth the trouble of sticking a lion there. Besides, Waterloo is the strangest encounter in history. Napoleon and Wellington, they aren't enemies, they are opposites. Never has God, who likes an antithesis, produced a more striking contrast or a more extraordinary confrontation. On one side, precision, foresight, geometry, prudence, an exit plan assured, supplies well managed, a stubborn sang-froid, an imperturbable approach, strategy that makes the most of the terrain, tactics that counterbalance battalions, carnage laid out like a map, war regulated by the clock, nothing deliberately left to chance, good old traditional courage, absolute correctness. On the other side, intuition, divination, military idiosyncrasy, a superhuman instinct, the flamboyant eye of a hawk, which watches and strikes like lightning, prodigious skill wedded to a contemptuous impetuosity, all the mysteries of a deep soul, a close connection to destiny, the river, the plain, the forest, the hill, marshaled and in some amazing way forced to obey, with the despot going as far as to tyrannize the battlefield. Faith in the stars melded to the science of strategy, expanding it but also muddying it. Wellington was the Barême of the war. Napoleon was its Michelangelo. And this time, genius was beaten by arithmetic. On both sides, they were waiting for someone. It was the one who was best at sums who succeeded. Napoleon was waiting for Grouchy. He did not turn up. Wellington was waiting for Blücher.